The British naturalist Helen MacDonald writes a lot about the interactions we humans have, or try to have, with wild animals. A few years ago, she wrote a book called H's for Hawk. It's a memoir about taming a wild goshawk. She named it Mabel. The book was a huge hit in the UK and here. Helen was back doing another round of book talks recently, and she and I got together to talk about her life after Mabel.
Well, Mabel's become a superstar.
You know? I know, she
has. When I wrote the book, I didn't expect this to happen, but people coming up and sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, she's still around, and I'm saying, no, she's not, but I still have this, a lot of her old malted feathers in a vase on my desk, you know. Oh. She died very suddenly a few years ago of a horrible fungal infection, but yeah, Mabel was a superstar, and people really, really love her.
So these days, I've read you have a parrot, though.
I have a parrot now, it's true. This makes me laugh. My friends have constantly been telling me it's emotionally more healthy to have a parrot because it's cuddly, right? Mabel was lots and lots of things, but she was never cuddly. And I always come back and say that, you know, I've had more scars from my parrot.
Really?
Than I ever had from my hawk. Because although hawks are very heavily armed, they're incredibly honest emotionally. You know, they're very simple beings. They're very solitary in the wild. So if you upset a hawk, it just gets upset and then it forgives you. If you upset a parrot, you're in trouble. Because it's going to come and get you, right? So when I occasionally upset my parrot, it bites. And yeah, there's a lot of bites. And, you know, I love my parrot. I'm having said that, it's a wonderful creature. But
what's
it's like
its
living
name?
With a person more than a bird. It's called Birdle. You know, Birdle. It just happens.
So I read somewhere you wrote that your parrot is actually vindictive.
Yeah. It can be vindictive. But, you know, everyone can. So, but I think, you know, parrots.
But how so? What does it do?
Oh, it'll remember and get me back later.
Tell that story you told somewhere or other. I can't remember where I read it. The one about the parrot and your mother. She was trying
to feed
it. Oh, the
lentil. Oh, this is so funny. This is classic, right? My mum and the parrot got on so well. And then one day I went out and my mum was sort of, the parrot's out of the cage all the time, you know, and it was wandering around the sort of table. Mum was having a lunch and she had a lentil salad with vinaigrette on the lentils. And the parrot loves lentils. So she offered one to the parrot, which came over and took this lentil and then went, ew, you know, because it was vinegary and spat it out. This was fine. My mother made the mistake of then picking up the same lentil and offering it again. And the parrot came up, took the lentil, and it was still disgusting. And it dropped it and just stared at her. Like, what are you thinking? And then walked towards her and bit her very, very hard. And that was the end of their relationship. It was terrible.
Does the parrot still not like her?
Well, no, I think what's happened is that my mum's quite scared of the parrot now. And of course, the worst thing is now that my mother's scared of the parrot and the parrot knows this and the parrot thinks this is hilarious because all it has to do is walk towards my mum looking threatening and my mum will back away. It's heartbreaking.
But I have to say, so I'm listening to this. You're an expert naturalist, you're a scientist, this sounds like gigantic anthropomorphization, doesn't it? Like,
but
you're attributing all these emotions to the parrot.
Of course,
which maybe
I am.
It doesn't have.
I think anthropomorphism is an incredibly interesting thing, and I kind of am worried about the way that it's just routinely dismissed. I kind of believe animals run on emotions. And parrots are particularly interesting like that. I mean, I think this wonderful kind of slightly animistic term of non-human person is perfect for a parrot. These are creatures which live in social groups like, you know, like sort of apes and monkeys. They're very intelligent. They've discovered that some species of parrots give their young chicks names in the nest.
Really?
I mean, scientists call them individual identifiers, but basically names.
But it sounds.
Yeah, it's little sequences of chirps and chips, which the birds will elaborate on, maybe, but they use that name all their lives and they use it to signify each other when they're calling each other.
Wow.
So I think, you know, how can I not anthropomorphize that parrot, you know? I mean, they're people, they're just not human.
So it sounds like one of the things you're suggesting is that we've created this false dichotomy where between our human world and the quote-unquote wild world. And increasingly, the story we tell about the wild, of course, is the ways in which we humans have ruined it.
Yeah.
And maybe as a result, we think the most moral position to take is to stay the hell away from anything wild and away from wild spaces, lest we ruin them all anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very strange situation we find ourselves in. You know, we're basically living through the sixth great extinction right now, you know, caused entirely by us. The world's getting quieter and sadder and more empty all the time. And we're taught that nature is precious. It is. And we're taught that nature, we shouldn't touch it. And I think that's very dangerous. I really do. Well, in lots of ways. You know, for example, in England now, there's a kind of small salamander called the great crested newt. Possibly the first time the great crested newt has ever been mentioned on this radio station. And it's very rare in Europe. It's quite common in England. And it's so protected that it's actually illegal for people to put their hands into a pond and drag one out to show their kids. Or
it's illegal even to touch one.
Yeah, yeah. You're not supposed to disturb them at all. And I remember going to a conference once, and this guy in the audience put his hand up and said, "What's the point of protecting them then, basically, if we can't touch them or see them?" And there was an uproar, right? But of course, these animals have intrinsic value for themselves and for their systems. But he made this point and he said, no one's going to want to protect or anything or save anything if they have no knowledge of it whatsoever and they've only seen it in pictures and they can't viscerally go and see it and touch it and learn to love it in the real world. And I've never forgotten that, you know.
I don't know if you've ever seen a wild animal in an urban space, but I've, you know, been walking down my neighborhood street at an odd hour and seen a fox suddenly run across the street, mm-hmm. or once seen a coyote suddenly run across the street. And it's a pretty amazing experience when you see an animal that you think shouldn't belong in your section of the world.
Right. And particularly if they look at you as well. There's been a lot written about the animal gaze. You know, sort of John Berger writing about the fact that we usually observe animals. The fact that they can observe us seems to have been forgotten. So certainly when you come across a fox or an owl and it turns its head and looks right at you, there can be moments of real confrontation with your idea of yourself, you know. My most kind of common experience of a very wild animal in an urban setting are peregrine falcons, which, you know, back in the day there were hardly any left because of DDT and shooting, and now they're these really familiar inhabitants of built-up cities, and they live on skyscrapers, and I've talked to people who've said, you know, they've been sitting in their office and they've turned and there's a peregrine falcon sitting on their windowsill looking right at them. And the number of people who've said to me, it was like a religious experience. Here I was in this mundane office, and suddenly there was this wild creature staring right at me. And I felt like I'd been sort of singled out for some special, almost sort of sacred moment. It's really interesting how that happens.
But say more about what you think that is.
Well, that's a lot of things, I think. And partly it's that we don't expect to see wild creatures, very wild creatures, close up, let alone in our office windows looking right at us like the boss is staring through, you know. But also, I think a lot of the wild creatures, like wolves, like hawks, they've had millennia of significant social, religious and mythical meaning for us. And I think those stories about them are still there. We still have carry them sort of bubbling along inside, deep down.
Red Riding Hood and the Wolf.
Right. Yeah. So when a wolf looks at you or a falcon looks at you, some part of you, you know, knows that there's some significance there, which might be more than just, here's a bird on my windowsill, right? If it was a chicken, it would be a different situation.
Well, and to bring us full circle back to what we've lost when we try to make a very clear, sharp boundary between us and the wild, it cuts off that movement, that extension of empathy and sympathy between us and the non-us, I guess is what you're saying.
It does, and it makes the world a lot smaller and it lessens it for us, I think. And I know it sounds, I'm saying things that make it sound like it's all about us, but when you surround yourself by things that are like you, and you're in that sort of bubble, the human bubble, and you don't love difference, you love things that are like you, I think that's a great, great shame. And I think a lot of the sadnesses in the world come from that movement of wanting to just be surrounded by yourself. I get out there. Get out there and watch the spiders and the sparrows in the puddles and, you know, enjoy the wonder of the world.
Helen, thank you. It's a pleasure talking.
And you, I've had a great time.
Helen MacDonald is the author of H is for Hawk and a collection of poems called Shaler's Fish.